Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for liking, subscribing, sharing, following, and giving us those 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you listen to your podcast. We really appreciate it. We've got this is kind of a special episode. It's going to be split across 3 different shows. So They Had to Go Out is branching out to more than just the Coast Guard. Because a lot of different people have to go out, right? And a lot of people still carry that same legacy and mindset of those early life-saving crews, including those that respond from the beach. So you got They Had to Go Out Beach Rescue that's profiling a lot of ocean lifeguards, a lot of harbor masters and entities like that. And then They Had to Go Out Distant Shores. It's covering our international partners and counterparts that are on shores far from the United States coast. So we welcome all those guests. I know that you guys are going to get something from it. We've already recorded several episodes for each show. And let me tell you, they're truly dangerous, daring, and epic stories across the world.
They're good.
And it's something that we can all learn from. So please give them a shout or give them check them out. And look forward to talking with you guys and getting your feedback on them. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, everybody. Like I always say, if it's your first time, which there's probably a good chance it's your first time as we kind of branch out into some new places, go and check out our other versions, other episodes, other places to find us. Check out stuff we've got on video. You can follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, anywhere. You just go into a search engine, type in They Had to Go Out, and you'll find us. Once you find us, if you've got a good story, contact us. We'd love to hear your stories. Even if you don't think it's a good story, I bet it probably is. After you listen and you love what you hear, because we know you're going to, give us those 5-star reviews and tell us what you'd like to hear moving forward, please.
For sure. And, just to boot stomp on that 5-star review, that's really what gets traction with any podcast. So please make sure you review. Hey, we've got a good one for you today, and this is going to be one that crosses boundaries on all the new versions of the podcast, and definitely take us all the way back to our legacy, because we've got a Coast Guard veteran on. And without too much ado here, who we've got on the line, former retired commander Gary Thomas, who graduated from the Coast Guard Academy in 1986, Bachelor of Science in Mathematics, so he's much smarter than Bill or I. He commanded several units during his time in the Coast Guard, both afloat and ashore, earning his permanent cutterman's pin, and attended the Joint Forces Staff College, graduating with honors from the University of Miami School of Business. where he earned a master's degree in computer information systems and just boot stomping how much smarter he is than Bill and I, and then a graduate certificate in telecommunications. So a well-educated guest for sure, and one that's been out to sea and seen some action. You know why he's crossing all the different podcasts? He's an amateur historian by avocation and currently the executive director for the Foundation of Coast Guard History, as well as serving as the vice president of history and heritage for the Association for Rescue at Sea. And the Association for Rescue at Sea, the podcast has recently partnered with, not only to promote their mission and what they're doing to particularly to help developing countries, you know, build out some kind of ocean rescue capability, and also to award acts of heroism that are performed at sea. So excited to have him on. He also serves, you know, tying it back to the original podcast, as an exhibit design consultant to the National Coast Guard Museum Association. So Mr. Thomas fully rounds out, you know, all the tentacles that the podcast has developed in recent years. And we are so excited to have him on board. Yeah, pretty much checked every box. So with that, Mr. Thomas, welcome aboard, sir.
Well, aloha. Thank you for having me.
Sir. It's always nice to have a cutterman.
Few and far That's between.
My happiest accomplishments in the Coast Guard.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's a good one. Well, with that, sir, welcome. We're glad you're here. And I'll ask the question. What's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
So, I'm kind of contrarian sometimes and go against the established rules. So rather than an in-depth view of one of my most famous ones, I really thought I'd take three short ones that were meaningful to me in my career, but also had an impact on the Coast Guard in general, and show people how their individual actions some kind can change the organization itself. And so the first one was
when I was a brand new ensign on the cutter Evergreen,
and I was designated the rescue swimmer. Now, I qualified as a rescue swimmer for one reason. I was a qualified diver and could fit into the wetsuit that they had on board and wouldn't have to buy a new one.
That sounds like cutter ops to me.
Yeah. I never did that on a cutter. I never said, hey, you'll fit, you go. That never happens anymore.
And hey, Mr. Thomas, what was the Evergreen?
Evergreen was a
WEC-295. Also
commonly known as the Evergon. We spent a lot of days underway. But she was a white-hulled converted 180 buoy tender without the buoy arm. And in fact, the only buoy she ever worked was one we towed when the Nantucket L&B broke free in a storm.
Wow. Okay. That's good. Yeah, that's cool. That's good. Yeah.
But this was the late 80s, and even then, the aviation rescue swimmer program that is so famous now had just begun developing a few years before that. So no one really taught you how to do anything. I picked it up because I was a good swimmer, and I worked with the Navy base at the Groton Subcommand on how to rescue people. But it really didn't matter because back then, you never deployed the rescue swimmer. The rescue swimmer was a checkbox item for when you went through exercise, was the rescue swimmer there? And everybody knows you never deploy the rescue swimmer, actually, until when underway in heavy seas, your BM-2, who's doing topside rounds, goes in the water. And so we actually had to conduct a shipboard recovery of one of our own crew in heavy seas. And so I learned a lot about saving people and how real it becomes when you're in the water, in heavy seas, cold water, rescuing one of your shipmates.
What were heavy seas, Gary?
Well, I'm sure by my sea story at this point, there were 30 or 40.
Perfect. Feet, that's what I was going for. That's what I wanted to hear.
But I think the log recorded them as 6 to 8 and about 39 degree temperature.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. But if the guys on the bridge were recording 6 to 8, they were 12 to 14 probably. So. For sure.
Minimum.
Right.
So, but, you know, the interesting thing about when that happened was, you know, there was no formal program for the Coast Guard. And with our incident, as well as some others, cutter forces back in headquarters went, you know what, we really ought to need to have a formal program with training and qualification. And so a large part of our feedback from that evolution went towards Coast Guard having a change in policy and for the better. It's now a position you qualify for, train for, and you stay concurrent in. And you know, that whole idea of one person's individual actions can have an impact is, you know, that BM-2 we got out of the water went on to continue to serve until Master Chief and having LMC commands. So think about just not only him, but all the people he served with and he touched in his career. So, you know, you do have that impact even as an individual.
For sure. And that's, you know, it's funny that you bring that up. So I we just interviewed Peter Iden, who was aboard the Coast Guard cutter Cuyahoga and was a survivor from the cutter, right? And his daughter sent a review, and her photo happened to come up. And if you could see the size of the family that, you know, that's been created there, you know, just testament to, yeah, I mean, one person can have a huge reach going forward. So definitely a good point. What did you guys specifically bring up for the Cutter Swimmer program at the time? Like what was your take on it, I guess?
The first thing was we needed to have a training program for it. I used my off time to qualify for what I consider qualification. It was never something we did during shipboard routine, never actually went in the water. So our recommendation included training the way you react as we do with other things. Mm-hmm. So kind of formalize that concept. The equipment we had was terrible. It was really just old surplus dive gear, wetsuit kind of stuff, which was not really the most appropriate thing. And then the idea is that we have to make sure that it's standardized across the fleet. We do everything else standardized across the fleet, then we should have it standardized here too.
For sure. For sure. Step on one cutter and everything's the same. Absolutely. And what rank were you, Gary, when you volunteered for that duty or were voluntold?
I was mounted, and I was an ensign.
It was probably
my third or fourth underway period.
Okay.
Okay.
It was one of those interesting things. If you remember, we always get underway and we run through a whole series of drills
so you can get them out of the way and
so you're ready to go.
And we'd gone through all the standard drills, and I was going to have the 16 to 20 watch. And so I'd gone to my rack to lay down for a few minutes before that. And all I hear now is man overboard, port side. And my first thought was, I'm going to have to kill the XO. He's running yet another drill when I'm trying to take a nap. And then you hear the words, this is an actual DM2 on port side. And your brain just goes into a whole different level of action and commitment to what you're doing.
For sure. And you saying that, like, it was kind of an undefined duty, really, right? You just knew that you were going to have to go in the water. So what was kind of your decision making process in that? Hey, this is a real event. What, and how did you know what to do, I guess?
So, I mean, fortunately, and here's where history ties into it. I had learned about the Coast Guard's use of tethered swimmers, which dates back to World War II and Charles David and the sinking of the Dorchester. So I had an idea of what to do. And, you know, I'd been around water all my life, so I was comfortable swimming and things like that. And I worked with some of the crews at the Navy submarine base about what do you do when you escape from a sub? And, you know, how do you manage yourself on the surface? So I had those ideas. I really don't remember getting dressed out. I remember the most difficult thing was, as they were maneuvering the ship alongside, was to find the individual in the water. Because this was back in the days when we had those green pea, olive drab kind of overcoats.
Okay.
Which, when they get wet, turn dark, and you're in dark water in gray conditions. And it was the hardest thing was trying to find him, so that once I got into the water, I knew where to go.
And how was he once you got to him?
He had actually gone under twice by the time I got to him, and I was able to get to him before he went under a third time, and I brought him into a tow, and it was about 25 yards off by the time we got him back in, and then we brought him in, and he was struggling a great deal. And so what we ended up doing was I just wrapped my arms around him with my arm through the cargo net. And rather than try and get him to climb up the cargo net, the crew just pulled the whole cargo net with us on it and then dumped us on the deck.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, that's a different way to do it.
Right. And was that right at like where the buoy port would have been when it was a buoy tender?
It's exactly where it was.
Okay.
Solid question, Bill. I know you're just like, let's paint that thing black and get it back out there pulling buoys.
I don't want to take the story. I've never done it for real. I've only done it for training.
Yep.
Off of a buoy tender when I was on Idaloos, I was one of the swimmers. And I don't know about you, sir. I know the first time I jumped in the water and looked back, I thought the Titanic was beside me. Like, the ship doesn't seem that big when you're on it.
Well, Bill, you're right. It does look like the Titanic's alongside you, and especially at the very end as they maneuver and your ship falls into the swell and gets in the trough and starts rolling, and you're seeing the bilge keel and things like that as you're trying to swim to it to get picked up. It is a little unnerving.
Yeah, I could absolutely imagine.
Yeah, for sure.
Bill, I can't picture you as a swimmer, but you, I also couldn't picture you as a lifeguard, and you are a lifeguard. So
believe it or not, Phil, that's the only sport I actually have talent at.
Yeah.
Like, on land, not a coordinated guy. I'm like a seal. In the water, I'm graceful. Out of the water, not good.
So, Gary, with the rescue of the BM2, what was kind of the outcome? On the ship, was it just backslaps and high fives, or how did that go?
So that was the general feeling. The funny part about it was as they were pulling the cargo net up with me holding him, he panicked a little bit at the very end and kicked me in the crotch, just knocked the wind out of me. And so as the cargo net was dumped on deck, everybody went to him as they should, made sure he was great. And I'm just kind of laying in the corner in a fetal position.
But that's one of those stories you don't get to live down quickly either, huh?
No, not at all. But, it was very sobering because it was, within hours of starting a patrol in the Northwest Atlantic in wintertime. So it made everybody very, very conscious about their handholds when topside in bad weather.
For sure.
And two questions for you, Gary. So you're in a wetsuit, right? You said not a dry suit. You're in a wetsuit.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. In the middle of winter in the North Atlantic. So probably that was probably a pretty harsh experience the second you hit the water.
No, to be honest, I think my adrenaline was going such that I had no recollection of the water temperature or anything.
Okay. I wonder.
I really did not.
Did you figure out like where he fell from? Because I know you said you pulled him in from the buoy port. That's where I imagine he would have fallen from too, because I don't know. Did you guys have like just kind of nets across there?
No, so actually that's not where it was. The Evergreen had been an oceanographic research vessel early in her life.
Okay.
And so on the port side, we actually had a deck landing that would fold out over the water, because that's where scientists would do work.
Okay, so she was pretty heavily modified.
Correct. Okay. And, just had a safety pin in there that fell free, and he had noticed it, and as he went to put the safety pin back in place, we took another heavy roll, and he just pushed through and out into the water.
Mm. Mm. Lucky. But very lucky.
Yeah, it was good housemanship by the OD, and most importantly was – people talk about the importance of a lookout to not only see what's ahead of you, but what's right immediately around you and the crew, and that's important.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, great lessons learned. What? Let's go to the next one, Gary. I want to hear all three.
So the next one was when I was CO of the Cutter Padre up Key West of one of the 110s. And this is back when in the early 90s when we were having the mass migration of Haitians.
Is this when you met Carrie?
Carrie and I met at the Coast Guard Academy back in 1984.
Oh, okay. So, all right, good.
But this point, we had been married 5 years already, I believe.
Oh, okay. All right.
And had a daughter. So
two 110 COs that were married down there, huh?
Yeah, I had mine, and then she followed it immediately 2 years later.
So very cool.
We spent the first 11 years of our marriage trading back-to-back sea tours.
And you were the guinea pig, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
But... We were just patrolling off Haiti, waiting to see if any more Haitian migration flow was coming out. And early in the morning before sunrise, we got a call to go in towards Port-au-Prince that a Haitian ferry had been reported overdue and was suspected to have sunk. And as we headed in, it nothing seemed wrong. It was one of those days that's flat, calm, bright sunshine. Not what you think about of going to rescue people from a ferry sinking. And our lookout noticed a person off in the distance floating the water. And so we headed over in that direction. And as we came alongside, we realized that it was just a body face down in the water. And we went down to check on him to see if it was alive, the person was alive or not, and is clearly dead. But as we were just drifting there, assessing the situation, my bridge crew was looking out, and we suddenly realized that we're literally floating alongside a dead body in the midst of what turned out to be hundreds of dead bodies.
Oh, wow. Ugh.
And, once we realized that this individual was not alive, we said, okay, well, let's go see who's alive. And we ended up spending several hours driving through a sea of dead bodies. And it took a while before another cutter were on scene. We did eventually give up on searching for anybody being alive and then went back into recovery mode. At one point we had 3 dozen bodies on her fantail. We didn't carry body bags at the time. So, we stripped every bunk of our sheets and blankets and things like that. And nothing in the Coast Guard that you ever formally train on teaches you how to deal with something like that. And if you've ever recovered a body from the water, it's certainly not for faint of heart.
No, not at all.
Yet what I found was that my crew brought on board, and this included literally mothers with their arms locked around dead babies and dead mothers, that my crew treated them with more dignity and respect than the Haitian authorities did when we returned to port and turned over the bodies, and they were just tossing them and stacking them. So it's one of those situations where you see your shipmates rise above themselves, and not because of any training the Coast Guard had, but it was simply because of the culture that we serve in that just starts to permeate into how you do everything. Mm-hmm. And no matter how your brain is wired, the experience of driving through hundreds of dead bodies is not something that you can deal with well. This was 1990, the standard Coast Guard coping mechanism was go to the bar at port call and drink yourself silly. So
that maintained for a long time.
It did.
Right. And some people still think that's the coping mechanism.
Yeah. And this is again, this was even before the current Gulf wars that we've been involved in. And so nobody really thought of PSTD as something in the country or the military. You thought about the shell-shocked World War II and the crazies from Vietnam, and I use air quotes for crazy because they were not. But the Coast Guard wasn't there. But fortunately, I was able to run into a wonderful woman in headquarters named Jan Gray, who was starting to deal with something called critical incident stress management, which was started by firefighters because they realized that a culmination of a lot of bad, stressful things can be difficult on your mind. It doesn't have to be being traumatic going to war. It can be a series of watching people die in fires and things like that. And so Jan was able to get the Coast Guard on board with critical incident stress management and coping skills that were involved. And I was happy to relay all of our experience with her and fortunate enough to become one of the early instructors for that. And I'm happy to see is that that experience was able to bolster her case that this is something the Coast Guard needs. And I'm happy to see now is that when the Coast Guard crews experience bad things, whether it's you're picking up the body of a jumper off a bridge or anything like that, is the Coast Guard realizes that we need to deal with the mental component of our coping with those incidents. So I was happy to be part of a really negative situation for me and my crew that many of us still have very clear, vivid memories of what this hundreds of bodies looks like in the water. But they gave us an opportunity to take that experience and make it into something good for the rest of the Coast.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal lesson to learn. I'd be curious, what did you guys do in the immediate aftermath? So the rest of that took a while to kind of come to fruition with SISM. What did you as the CEO of the cutter seeing, I'm sure you have a junior crew. We're talking what, like 10, 11 people?
So we had 15 at the time.
15.
We had a little bit of an augmented crew. The first thing they did, the Navy flew into to Guantanamo Bay with us and said, a psychiatrist, and said, you are going to have problems. All of you are going to be scarred for life. And a whole bunch of us who were older and who had found bodies in the dead water before or dead in the water before, kind of went, this sucks, but I'm not going to go kill somebody for it. And so that's where I needed to step in with my chief, who was older and more experienced than I even, and say, you don't have to say you're going to be traumatized before it. It was a bad situation. And take time to assess in your own mind what this means to you. And then we were very cautious because we stayed out. We didn't go back to home port for another couple of weeks. And so we were just very cautious in how people behaved on our port calls. And we very closely, XO, she was put in charge of monitoring, is watch performance staying up or are people being distracted by it? Mm-hmm. And we, it's a small crew and it's a tight crew. So we were able to sit on the mess deck, over lunch. And you have the typical gallows humor about, picking dead bodies up out of the water and things like that. But what we found was that talking through it, even in gallows humor,
can be a very therapeutic way of dealing with things. So the biggest thing we learned was to make sure we monitor the behavior of the crew, and that we gave them a way of releasing that tension and emotional buildup.
Perfect. Solid. Sure. Solid answer. What, so when you took it up to the headquarters level, what was the plan for the rollout, I guess? What specifically did CISM want to provide someone, you know, say that 110 CO that just recovered 200 bodies from a sunken ferry, what would CISM provide them?
So what it, I mean, it's a very lengthy program overall, but the idea is that not everybody experiences these traumatic events the same way. Mm-hmm. Some are deeply affected, others are not, and that there are different levels of dealing with them. It may be something as simple as what CISM calls a debrief, and that is getting everybody into the room who experienced it to talk about it factually. Because part of what problems is, it's like the sea story. The story evolves of what you really experience, and your brain starts incorporating things that didn't happen into your memory of that experience. So if you can get people to start talking about it in only factual terms, what did you see, what did you experience, it suddenly lets the brain release a little bit of going, oh, maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought it was, because here's what really happened. Mm-hmm. Great. And so, you know, the training program went out everywhere, and, you know, at the time, groups back then had people who were eventually become trained in it who could respond to their arrival of the cutter back and talk the crew through it. And if you found is that there were people who were significantly impacted, who couldn't follow their duties or something like that, then there was able to be resources to take them on to true mental health professionals.
For sure. Not, you know, not like Bill said earlier, not to steal the story or anything, but I remember at Golden Gate picking up bodies all the time. You'd picked up so many, right? Especially the guys that mm-hmm. had been there for a while. You would get someone new in, and you would just kind of cope the way that you had always coped with picking mm-hmm. up a dead body. But then you had this new guy that had never done it before. And I think it's very valuable for an outside entity to come in and just get everybody to reset and talk it through. So Bravo Zulu, I think it's a huge program that's very impactful.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the biggest thing was getting the Coast Guard and senior leadership to finally accept that we should be dealing with this as a mental health issue that goes to the readiness of the Coast Guard, and that just because some person can gut it out doesn't mean everyone can. You know, for me to go to Golden Gate and pick up a dead body out of the water, having already done that, is going to be an entirely different experience from a brand new seaman whose father committed suicide.
For sure. Yep, absolutely. Great way to put it.
So,
and everybody's going to deal with it. You may deal with 10 of them really well, and that 11th mm-hmm. one may be the one that gets you, and everybody's different and every time's different for everybody, and there's no right or wrong. Well, there are probably wrong unhealthy ways to deal with it, but the way you experience it for everybody is their way. There's no right or wrong way to experience it,
and that point is exactly what we Jan brought forward to the leadership, and that is everybody thought of PTSD kind of shell shock things of going to war and tragic things you see there. But what the CISM program worked from, it was from firefighters who just have low-level bad incidences that over time build up. Mm-hmm. And that was much closer to, you know, we talk about it as, you know, our small boat stations and cutters being like firemen and policemen more than than warriors. And so the analogy of that low level of stress keep building and building and building, we need to have the release valve to let it happen easily and in a manageable, healthy way, instead of just blowing up by getting drunk or whatever it might be.
For sure. Yeah. Start the conversation early before it gets to that point. I love it. I think that's vital. That was good. I like that. Yeah. That was an awesome, I never knew about the origins of the whole program. Was there anybody who else was, I mean, I'm sure a ton of people were involved, but any other catalyst incidents that you're aware of, Gary, that kind of brought that out?
I don't remember them specifically. I know Jan Gray had been working hard on the program, and mm-hmm. she's just an amazing person to have gotten it done. We just happened to have an incident that helped show where it would be valuable. There's no way that our incident caused it to happen. It was Jan's work that made it happen. We just gave her a really good poster child of why it's important.
For sure. And what was the name of the incident that you responded to? Did they ever, you know, what was the, how did they refer to it?
It was the motor vessel Neptune. If you Google it, you'll find a New York Times article. They think that more people than died in the Titanic died. it was potentially as high as 1,800 people.
Wow.
Wow. If you'd ever seen Haitian ferries at that time, they just kept piling them on. People would be hanging on stanchions on the rub rail to go across. And what happened was a storm came up on the starboard side very quickly. And so everybody rushed to the port side, and she simply rolled over and sank and took most of the people down. And for the most part, Haitians don't swim, so there was no chance that they went in the water. Mm-hmm. I think they had about 75 people make it ashore.
Do you know where she was like going between?
Going from the South Claw of Haiti to the North Claw of Haiti, geography there.
Wow.
Okay.
But so they suspect as many as 1,800 people may have died.
Yeah, and you know, one of the learning moments I think from that whole thing too would just be the value that Americans place on human life that isn't necessarily a global thing.
It's not, and that is to this day. I mean, I have lots of visual memories of it, but I still remember is the disregard the Haitian authorities had to the solemnness of what we were doing, of carrying them off the brow, lining them up in a nice neat row, respectfully. And then watching him just grab them, drag them, and throw them in the back of a truck.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate to see. I hope the next one's happier, Gary. We're in the middle of a quarantine, man. Like, whew.
He started out with a really good story. We're going down. Now it's time to come back.
All right, I wouldn't say we're going down. You know, I mean, the outcome of that was huge, right? Hugely positive.
Right. Yeah,
maybe we got like a positive one next.
So act three.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
So, as you noted in my service history, I come from the Loran community, Loran Navigation System. And for all the young kids out there who think GPS has always existed and that you've always had an iPhone to show you where you're at, that was not the case. And one of the premier navigation systems was the Loran Navigation System, operated by the Coast Guard worldwide. It was a high-frequency radio navigation system. And in order to get the coverage worldwide, Coasties were in really odd places, like Attu, Alaska, at the end of the Aleutian Chain, French Frigate Shoals, which looks like a box set in tow of the water. And that was a runway and the Loran Station, and nothing more in the middle of the Pacific. Okinawa, Japan. Lampedusa, Italy, which was where, when Gaddafi was mad with Ronald Reagan in the 80s, he fired a missile at the Loran Station on Lampedusa, thinking he would get America's military spun up. It ended up in the water. Nobody was hurt. And then Gaddafi got was bombed heavily by Ronald Reagan.
Hear, Ronald Reagan. Way to look out for him.
But because of the odd places and the isolation, in many places, they were the only military presence from the U.S. in the country. They got the nickname Loranimals, just because, you're stuck out.
I do too.
I really like that. It was making me smile too.
Yeah. So
I think there's a t-shirt we need to make.
Well, actually, if you Google it, you'll find there's lots of t-shirts that we've all created over the history, because that goes back to 1942. But there's not many Loranimals left in the Coast Guard. Although I would say is that Master Chief Vander Hayden, the current Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard, is in fact a Loranimal.
He served on
Okinawa, or Iwo Jima, excuse me. It's a really interesting career path. It's gone by the wayside. But one of the things about it was, in order to have that high-frequency radio transmission that traveled hundreds of miles, the Coast Guard used these huge vacuum tube transmitters. They're big, big, big ones, including the largest one had a 1.4 megawatt transmit power, which when you think about your typical Class A radio station is 50,000 watts. And these were over that by a magnitude. The problem was is that vacuum tubes create ionized radiation, which can cause cancer and all sorts of problems, which is very different from the radiation that your cell phone puts. That's why a cell phone to your ear is not giving you brain tumors, because the ionization is not there. So for a number of years, the Coast Guard was finding their veterans were getting all sorts of unexplained cancers and dying from cancers and things like that. And the cohort was all the Loranimals who'd served at these vacuum tube things. But the Coast Guard denied there was any single problem at all. And so unless the Coast Guard acknowledged a problem, the Veterans Administration will deny claims because it's not service-related if the Coast Guard won't acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was EXO with the Loran Support Unit, my first tour with Loran, I had been going through records, and I found cases where, you know, documents from the Coast Guard saying there is no risk, but we're going to put these lead shields around the tubes to make them safer. There is no lead or no risk, but here, wear some of these dosimeters for a little while so we can see what's going on. And, you know, there is no risk, but women of childbearing age are not allowed to be assigned to Loran stations. And
Gary, what made you look into that in the first place? Like, was it just a random report that you started seeing, or was it did something kind of preface you to look into the issue?
So I as I got talking with people, because even back then I was doing history presentations, and I was speaking to Coast Guard veterans from World War II who operated these similar kind of things, and noticed that people were dying off in cancer. And when I talked with my crew, they're like, "Oh yeah, like, you know, Bill had it, John had it, you know, boom, boom, boom." And eventually, my first Loran CO, he had cancer too. And so I get a little further along. I'm now CO, several tours later, CO of the same unit. And I'm finding out more. And I was linked up with a retired Master Chief, Chuck Severance, up in Alaska, who had just done this amazing research into the whole idea of this ionized radiation. And he came to me with the information. And we were able to convince a public health service doctor who was assigned to the Coast Guard, a commander, Dana Thomas, who's actually now the chief medical officer for the Coast Guard. And she said, "You know what, I'm willing to look into this a little bit more." And she did. And by this time, I'd already actually, as last CO, shutting down Loran when we canceled the program. I've moved on to headquarters, and now I'm chief of electronic navigation. And so these kind of things fall under my responsibility as a headquarters program manager. And I convinced my boss that we needed to get the band back together and go back to Wildwood and fire up one of the old tube transmitters. And that's exactly what we did. We spent 3 weeks bringing up a transmitter out of cold storage. And I had veterans from the 1960s through people who had been serving on it just a few years before in St. Paul, Alaska. And we brought the system back up, and we brought the Navy radiation experts, the people who look at what would happen after a nuclear war. And from that, we were able to get definitive results that showed this ionizing radiation would, in fact, be a health hazard and causing of cancer. And with that information, the Coast Guard said, "Okay, we do have a problem." They took that position to the VA, and the VA reversed course and acknowledged it as a hazard that could be rateable for veterans.
Phenomenal.
What a great thing to do.
Phenomenal outcome.
If you've ever worked with the VA and a claim, you know that once a claim is denied, that's it. So to get them to reverse course and look at new claims is like, you know, the biblical parting of the sea. And so I felt really good that we were able to get these people, get the Coast Guard to change their mind and come up with a new right answer.
Rightfully so. Yeah, that's awesome. You know what I was picturing too, you bringing back all these old veterans to kind of like get this thing back in operation. You know, the latest movie, Battleship, where they all take out the Indianapolis.
The one with Rihanna in it.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. But they, you know, all those guys come back. It's kind of the same thing, just like without aliens. You know, it's cancer, right. which is kind of alien to itself. But wow, what an awesome, awesome outcome and awesome project to get involved in.
Yeah, I was thinking of Down Periscope with Kelsey Grammer.
But. Yeah, same kind of thing. I can imagine how you talk about drinking problems, right? Like, it probably got wild. That's good.
But, you know, I chose those three episodes not to say, you know, see what I did, but really just to remind the listeners is that there are things that they do each day, and there are cases they're involved in, and they see things happening, that if you have the will, you can become an organizational change driver. You know, my first one was as an ensign. My second one was a lieutenant. Not real high in the organization. So when you see something that needs changing, be be willing to push the case.
Yeah, that's that good advice and definitely impressive, because people generally go out of their way not to listen to ensigns. So the fact that you were able to get some change at that level is impressive.
Yeah.
Well, and then also, you know, just going outside the organization, I mean, that last one had a much bigger impact than just the Coast Guard. I mean, you know, they were Coast Guard veterans, but you impacted the VA. So, yeah, boot stomp on that one that, you know, a good idea could definitely have applications all over the place. So get out there and start thinking, daring to read, write, think, and speak, as the Naval Institute says.
There we go.
Very cool. Well, Gary, talk to us a little bit, or talk to the audience a little bit, about the Association for Rescue at Sea.
Great. So, okay, the Association for Rescue at Sea, or what I'll call AFRAS as we talk, it's a nonprofit that provides worldwide support and assistance to volunteer rescue services and to recognize and honor extraordinary marine rescues. And you can find us at AFRAS.org on the internet. And this is actually it's a great thing we're talking about early on. You said, you know, you're starting to branch out to the other people who do rescues and things like that, and that is certainly within our wheelhouse for what we try to do. I joke that, like many good ideas in the Coast Guard, AFRAS started at a party over drinks.
See, there is something to be said for drinking. Don't ever fully discount it or say that it's entirely negative, because there are a lot of good things happen over drinks.
All the good stories start out at a party over drinks. It's just how do they end?
Just be responsible, you know, like have a driver. That's really what it boils down to.
Yeah. So, except this party was in 1976, and it involved the Commandant of the Coast Guard at the time, Admiral Seiler, and was at the U.S. Embassy in London, England.
Okay.
And in discussions with some folks there who were part of the Royal National Lifeboat Institute in the U.K., they started talking about how that could be support. Now, the RNLI is an all-volunteer organization.
I like to refer to them as our unpaid brothers from another mother.
That's exactly what it is. It is not a government-run organization like the Coast Guard is. And so when you think about the Coast Guard, for most Americans, and we think it's about small boat stations, having them imagine that it's an all-volunteer force, and I'm not talking about during the government shutdown when coasties weren't paid. I'm talking about these are real volunteers.
Quality distinction, Gary. Quality distinction.
But, you know, most Americans would be surprised that a large percentage of the shore-based rescues around the world are conducted by all-volunteer organizations, mm-hmm. working on donations, free service, and not government funding. And so from that first meeting in 1976, with the work of a large number of people, including Captain John Fuchel of the Coast Guard, who was the Coast Guard rep in London, AFRAS was born. And interestingly, you know, you mentioned that you guys are reaching out to the Newport News Mariners Museum.
Correct.
One of our first board members was William Wilkinson, who was the director of the Maritime Museum at the time.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Very cool. So,
small world, because, you know, we've also talked to your wife, who's the head of the CGMA. So it's kind of, you know, that's a very small world that we work in. I love it.
It really is.
So, but in fulfilling our mission, you know, we have two primary programs. One is providing funding or services in kind to those volunteer rescue organizations, and our annual awards program. You know, one of the questions we get is, why are we fundraising for volunteer organizations outside of the United States? And, you know, so the first answer is because it's the right thing to do. They are volunteers doing a mission that many of us on the board of AFRAS have done personally.
Mm-hmm.
And second, this is not always as easily apparent to some people, but this actually represents a force multiplier for the Coast Guard. And you might ask how that is. So, for example, we fund the Virgin Islands Search and Rescue Organization in the British Virgin Islands. It's called VISAR. You know, as you know, Coast Guard cutters patrol down in that area all the time. They're on Coast Guard missions doing the King's business. But if they are near the Virgin Islands and the Virgin Islands have a SAR case, the Coast Guard will divert and take over that SAR mission. Well, if we can keep VISAR conducting their own SAR cases, then that Coast Guard cutter doesn't get diverted. It stays on mission. It doesn't go in to the Virgin Islands water, and it keeps doing its mission. So we, by supporting VISAR to do their own rescues, we can help keep a Coast Guard cutter out at sea. And the same goes with some funding to the Dominican Republic's Navy that does some SAR work, the same with Haiti and other countries. So we look at it as the ability to allow the paid professionals to stay on their mission while you, the volunteers, are getting expertise, funding and equipment to do theirs.
For sure, an excellent mission, because if you think, you know, you think about the Coast Guard and the many varied missions that it has, highest priority is always SAR, right? So if the call comes in for a life to be saved, we drop it all and we go.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what a great, great mission statement, kind of playing the long game, I would think, right there.
Yeah. And we work internationally with a group called the International Maritime Rescue Federation. And we meet with them regularly. And these are people who coordinate the training and development of volunteer organizations around the world. You may recall from a few years ago, the recent tragic situations we had in the Mediterranean Sea, with the mass migration there. What most people, I mean, they heard of stories about the Italian Navy and the Coast Guard and things like that, but what was not really spoken about much was the vast majority of the people who were pulled safely from the water were volunteer organizations like the Yellow Boat Group from the Nordic countries and things like that. And we have worked to help support them because we work under the theory that Admiral Allen taught us years ago that, you know, there may be a lot of geopolitical issues involved in why the migration is happening. And to be able to solve the problem is a greater good than what we can do ourselves. But when you encounter a drowning person, they have no politics or causes. You simply save them. And that was the approach we took. These volunteer organizations were doing above and beyond to save people at risk at sea. And that was part of our support plan.
Chills, Gary. Well, you give me chills with that one. I love it. Yeah, I mean, that's you're right. Yeah, drowning person
of
has no
be
politics.
An Admiral Allen quote.
Yep, yeah. that was it. That's the quote right there. I love it.
Oh, we all have. I had the fortune of serving on his staff during Katrina, and I have lots of wonderful Admiral Allen quotes, not all of which are publicly available
for good reason.
So he is a word master when it comes to telling a story.
Man, I love that answer you just gave, Gary, because I was thinking, you know, when you were starting to talk about these volunteer organizations in the Med, the first place my mind went were all these geopolitical issues that you talked about that kind of would hamper rescues and that people fought against. And I mean, you saw, you know, live streamed YouTube videos from some of these boats, like, are we really going to let these people die over, you know, over a like you said, a geopolitical issue. Phenomenal work. Thank you guys for supporting those. Personal heartfelt thanks.
And we tend to look at supporting as where we, because, you know, everybody can give money to anything, and you can always give money. But we look very closely at, does it make a difference? For example, we're looking at Tanzania, which in Africa, they have a lot of places with large lakes, inland seas almost, that have ferries. If we can get one boat to them where they have none, then that cost will be able to save lives, literally, because they never had a capability that we just gave them. Whereas giving $10,000 to an organization that's already established, that's working on the margin for saving their organization. So we try and look very clearly at where were we going to have the impact for the dollars that are donated to us to put on these missions.
Phenomenal. I love it. I mean, what the best mission statement ever. That bar meeting back in the 70s, I'm glad that happened, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about...
But it was a heck of a cocktail party.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but, you know, it was a cocktail party.
So the second part of that, though, is what we're relatively well-known in the Coast Guard for, because it comes out as an all-coast awards program.
Hey, I can speak to this one, Gary, before you even answer. It's what every BM3 wants. That's what it, right? Like every BM3 has seen the message and they're all like, man, how do I get that? Sorry, go ahead.
That is just a wonderful thing to hear that's how it's reviewed, because we have a series of different awards. We have the AFRES Gold Medal, which goes to an enlisted man or woman for extraordinary acts of bravery during rescue at sea. And that pretty much says itself right there. We have a counterpart to that, which is called the Silver Medal, which is associated with the Coast Guard Auxiliary. And we have to be clear that silver doesn't mean second place, but rather refers to the fact that auxiliaries wear silver in their devices instead of the gold that the Coast Guard officers use.
I'm glad you didn't go for the color of the hair. Yeah, I'm sorry. Somebody had to say it. Come on. Somebody had to say it. Yeah, I know.
You know you're going to join the auxiliary.
You know I am. You know it's going to happen. Yeah, it's definitely happening.
I am. Carrying
Commodore Knoll sitting right there.
Yeah. We're going to do it. Kerry wants to be a radio watchstander, and I'm going to work with your auxiliary chef program.
Hey, I learned so much from auxiliary watchstanders that, you know, like that you would never get from active duty just because of their local knowledge and life experience. So more power to you if you make that happen.
Yeah. We also presented an award for the AMVR program, which is the Automated Mutual Assistance Vessel Rescue Program the Coast Guard runs.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that as important is because what most people don't think about is, number one, you know, 90 to 95% of all our goods come to America via the maritime industry. And, you know, they work on very tight schedules. So if a ship has to divert, you know, 100 miles doing 10 knots, you know, they're going to take days out of their travel, which costs them, in order to rescue people. And I think, you know, we agree that that's something that needs to be recognized. So we recognize those people. We also have introduced a couple years ago a cruise ship humanitarian assistance award because we noted a lot of cruise ships were doing similar rescues that AMVR did. And for them, mm-hmm. it's the same thing. They're taking away from their cash-paying customers to actually rescue somebody and do the right thing. So we recognize those crews now. And that is well-received. We've had Japanese crews, both from AMVR and cruise ship, come from Japan, come from Norway to our meetings to be presented the award. And I mean, we always have the commandant, the vice commandant, and senior leadership there. We get congressmen and senators come to it. And so it's really important that we do that. And then we have several other ones for responsible towing operators. They have an award, as well as Caribbean Search and Rescue Award for the Caribbean Basin, basically, because that's a strong focus for us. And we have the Coast Guard has strong ties with almost every Coast Guard in the Caribbean Basin on a daily basis.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, then, I mean, how do you, you know, what else do you say?
What,
awesome,
what a great bunch of programs. Awesome.
Yeah. And then I was brought on a couple of years ago as the Vice President for History and Heritage based on my work with the Foundation for Coast Guard History. And the idea was we needed to make our audience more aware of the shoulders that these award winners stood on. And so every year we include a History and Heritage moment where we talk about various elements of the history of search and rescue and the people who went before them to put in context what we were giving these people awards for. You know, so our first one we talked about, we had the crew of, or some of the crew from the Tamaroa for mm-hmm. the Perfect Storm Rescue, as well as the descendants of Charles David, who was that rescue swimmer I talked about during World War II who died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna tell you, I was impressed that you were able to work that in. I like that. That was definitely the historian angle.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about the vital role that cruise ships hold, because it is, you know, there's so many cruise ships out there. As we're finding out now as we quarantine people, cruise ships are all over the place. They are at the front of looking for people in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then last year I talked about the history of volunteer life-saving organizations. You know, your listeners would probably be surprised to find out that the moral imperative that we all have today to save people in distress on the water was not always the case in human culture.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back in history, if you were shipwrecked and made it ashore, you were a prime candidate for being taken into slavery. Because if God willed that your boat should sink, then God willed that you should be a slave.
Terrible. I'm glad that we've changed that outlook. Right? Thank goodness.
Yeah. So we've been able to bring in the history and get people to understand is what's going on today with all these extraordinary rescues by all these different organizations are important to recognize and to continue to do them.
Yeah, awesome, Gary. I'll ask you, since you are the historian and you've kind of went back to these, what's you know, just for listener example, what's one of the most impressive AFRES awards that you've seen given?
I think it would be let's see, I forgot the name of the rescue swimmer from the Hilo for last year, but we had video of the C-130 flying top cover for the 60 for the rescue deployer or swimmer deployed from, captured the whole thing on it. And I think it was 20 or 30 foot seas, and he would have to swim 20 or 30 yards against the wind and current to get to the life raft to take the next swimmer downwind enough to bid him into the hoist basket to be hoisted up. Then he'd have to, again, swim back that 20 or 30 yards to catch up to the raft that's blowing away to then do it again for, I think, five or six people. And having done 25 yards with one person, I can't fathom what it took mentally and physically for him to do that repeated trips in such severe conditions and get everyone safely on board.
Yeah, just a battle. I mean, just a physical battle for sure. Great, great story. Well, Gary, any parting shots?
I work with the museum exhibit design team.
I'm sorry. Thank God you mentioned that, because that was my next. I did have one last question for you.
Yeah.
What's the most impressive exhibit that you're working on?
So we're still at the stage of crafting what all goes into the museum.
Mm-hmm.
The Foundation for Coast Guard History, which I'm the executive director for, we sponsored with the museum, was bringing together about 30 different organizations that are affiliated with Coast Guard history, the Ancient Aviators, the Life Saving Association, the Lighthouse Society, things like that, who have been preserving Coast Guard history without a museum. And we asked them, what are the important stories we have to tell, of over 200 years, five different services. And we distilled that down to about 238 must-tell stories that exemplify what the Coast Guard and its predecessors were about. And then how do you neck that down even further to a museum that's got five floors and very mission-oriented themed things? So we don't have the specifics yet, but, you start looking at how do you combine different stories in one. So I'll tell you right now, Ida Lewis is going to be in there somewhere.
All right.
Because you want to talk about a mission. Here is Ida Lewis rowing in terrible conditions in what women wore back then to rescue Army people who had gotten drunk and fallen in the water. She went on to be a lighthouse keeper. It's like all these checkboxes of different parts of the Coast Guard story are there, and it's an amazing story. So it's just a matter of how do we tell the story in the way that is most meaningful to society. And the Foundation for Coast Guard History was formed in part was to preserve history until the museum came along. So we are staunch supporters of that effort. And we hope that more people will become involved, become a plank owner, join that organization, and stand by for what we hope is going to be a great museum.
I guarantee it's going to be a great museum, no doubt in my mind. And I know the National Coast Guard Museum does have a plank owner drive right now. I think they're looking for 230 people to sign up. I'm not sure how many we've got so far, but 230 in a kind of tight timeline to meet that goal. So if you're not a plank owner yet, I know it by heart. It's coastguardmuseum.org/out and become a plank owner for sure. Gary, where can people find AFRAS, and who are you guys encouraging to join? And then, if anyone wants to donate to the cause, which is a phenomenal cause.
So the best way is to go to on the web to AFRAS.org, AFRAS.org. And there's a donation and joining information right there.
Perfect. I know you guys have different tiers for there's active duty Coast Guard, there's auxiliary, and then I think associate members.
Right. So we would exactly right. You can see all that information on the website.
Perfect. And then, what was the last one? I just lost it. Yep. Oh, well, I lost it. I'll bring it back another time. we'll have
Not
you back
problem.
On at some point. Well, Gary, thank you so much. Thank you for what you're doing with AFRAS, with the Foundation for Coast Guard History, and with the National Coast Guard Museum. Thanks for your service to the country and, for your involvement in those three pretty top-tier issues that had a much wider impact. Love to hear the story. Love the example that you set for the rest of us to follow. And we thank you for your time today, sir.
It's my privilege. Thank you for asking me in.
Great. Thanks again, sir. Stay healthy. Stay safe out there. Thanks again.
All right. Aloha.
All right. Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooutcom or your favorite podcast platform, and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.